Welcome back to a very special edition of the D'Antonio Wingcast. I'm Ben from Blazers Edge, and I think my co-host Kevin Pelton should be calling in here any minute now.
You have a collect call from a federal correctional facility. Do you accept the charges?
I do accept the charges. Kevin? Kevin, you there?
Ben? What, are you going to post bail at some point?
Where are you right now?
Multnomah County. I mean,
still,
you know, I need to be free.
I can't believe they jailed you for an entire week for throwing your tie on the basketball court during an NBA game. Is that really how it goes down?
Well, you know, I can't blame them. I was out of line, and, you know, they did what they had to do to protect the safety of everyone involved. But I would have appreciated it if, you know, you would have bailed me out at some point within the last week.
Well, so let me get this straight. You used your one phone call from jail to call in to participate in the Wingcast, and now we're going to talk for 2 hours about the end of the regular season, do an entire playoff preview, and you're just in some random cubbyhole at the jail, and they're cool with this?
Well, they say the one phone call, but they don't say anything about how long the phone call is. So, yeah, I'm taking advantage of it to the fullest.
Let me guess. You paid off one of the security guards with a free PDF copy of your book, didn't you?
We couldn't even swing for the – you didn't even ask for the printed copy. You know, that's terrible negotiation.
All right. So to give people some backstory here, we either found ourselves in the middle of the absolute best practical joke or the absolute worst practical joke in the history of the world this past weekend, didn't we?
I would definitely say the best.
Well, see, that's a huge relief to me because, honestly, I was really, really worried. And I was worried right from the beginning. Now, just to fill everybody in maybe who wasn't there for this ridiculous meltdown that happened on Friday, the referees led by Ken Maurer called an absolutely atrocious game. Everybody agrees that they were just not up to snuff during the Dallas versus Portland game. And I was jokingly trying to come up with what would be the funniest reaction. And, you know, you're probably one of the most subdued, level-headed people that I know, certainly more level-headed than I am, especially, you know, in a raucous crowd like the Rose Garden. So I thought it would be funny maybe if I made up a story about you getting kicked out for throwing your tie and taking your shirt off at the game in protest of the refs. Now, you know, I ended up writing this, and I thought I had made it clear that it was a birthday joke because, you know, the next morning was your birthday. But I don't think everyone quite got that. Who are some of the people or maybe the kinds of people who were starting to ask you over the last week if you had really done what I said you'd done, basically whipping your tie like a lasso over your head, aiming for the paint?
Well, let's say that there was a Blazers employee who contacted me about this, a member of the front office, a national NBA writer. You know, didn't really seem to believe that it was true, but wanted to double-check and make sure that it wasn't true. So, you know, I'm not quite sure what to make of the response. I think Blazers fans were excited to hear that I was so supportive of their team and willing to put my freedom on the line to protest the refereeing in Friday night's game. But, you know, on the other hand, I'm a little troubled that people think so little of my journalistic objectivity that they think that, you know, I would run out onto the court in the middle of the game. And beyond that, I mean, while we're joking and having our fun, we should be clear that, you know, throwing anything on the court is terrible. It's dangerous for the players. It's dangerous for everyone involved. And that was the unfortunate part of Friday night's game, is that that did actually happen and people had to get ejected. But yeah, I can't believe people believed it.
You know what else is unfortunate? Getting tag teamed by female security guards on your way out of the arena, isn't it?
It's the little details like that that really should have tipped people off that maybe the story is not quite on the up and up.
Well, it wasn't just the people that you listed. We also had a local television host. We had multiple, you know, relatively prominent bloggers from across the country. I would say, no, and I'm not joking, it took almost a full 24 hours after Brandon Roy tore his meniscus for me to get more emails about, you know, is Roy going to be able to play in the playoffs than the emails I got about whether you had actually been kicked out of the stadium. I mean, people were really, really, I don't know if they were concerned or if they were gawking, you know, it was like, are they rubbernecking around your tragedy or what was going on? But you elicited a reaction that was absolutely unexpected for me. So to anyone who thought that that was real and they didn't understand the sarcasm, I apologize. To you, I apologize for smearing your good name, because we know that all around the NBA executive circles, Kevin Pelton is just that crazy consultant for the Pacers who gets kicked out of the Rose Garden.
Yeah, especially when I spent the third and fourth quarter sitting with the Pacers. So,
so basically your bosses are hanging out with you. You disappear, and you're gone for the night, and then 2 hours later a report surfaces that you've been kicked out of the game. That is so bad, dude. I can't believe you're taking this with a smile. If I was in your position, I'd be so pissed off. So that speaks to your quality character. That's why we have you on the single greatest podcast, single greatest named podcast also in the history of the basketball.
Well, you know, I have to do something in appreciation for you allowing me to spend the evening in the Gulliver Mansion when I was down in Portland for the weekend.
Welcome here in Portland anytime, KP. You know that. And Blazer fans, I think what they were really hoping for, you know, in hindsight, is they want the kind of person who's going to show that Che Guevara leadership capability here as we enter the turmoil of the offseason that could see Kevin Pritchard fired. I think they're pointing to you as being the point man, you know, rabble-rousing, you know, potentially, you know, carrying a torch, you know, painting your face maybe, just getting out in front of all the anger that's sure to develop if Paul Allen does decide to get rid of Kevin Pritchard.
Well, see, I see that as your role. And, you know, it's not the first time. I mean, obviously, you really inspired people with what you did in the Draft Kevin Durant blog. And, you know, I've read a lot of good things about how people responded to that. Some of them I read in an article that's hanging on the wall of your living room. So
it's my office, okay? It's my office. It's a living room hyphen / office.
I have both a living room and an office, and there's none of my articles framed and hanging on the wall, so you'll know.
Well, you can't frame the internet, KP.
I do have copies of the Wall Street Journal that I was in, sitting at my desk.
See,
I will admit that.
See, now you're just – see, there were all these inside jokes people aren't going to get. KP is giving me a hard time because I have a framed copy of the Oregonian page from right before the 2007 draft, which pits me against, you know, everyone who's making comments such as even cavemen know it's time to pick out. And then, you know, here's me, the crazy wingnut, saying it's time to draft Kevin Durant. So the article came out in a legitimate newspaper, you know, a real mainstream publication. Maybe you've ever heard of it, KP, called The Oregonian. And so I happen to have that framed as inspiration next to my computer. And here you're dogging me out. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. This is why I left you in jail for a week. to think about it.
You know what they say, the co-hosts who laugh together, I don't know, have a good podcast or something.
Yeah, they cast pods together. Good point. All right, let's get on to real topics, not imaginary fiction topics. Well, so that's one thing, though. Should we just start writing fictional accounts of these games? I mean, is that the new, you know, everything's kind of been done here in the NBA. Like, should we just write more entertaining fictional recaps, like Travis Dean or triple-double, you know?
Well,
oh, wait, you like did have a triple-double last night. That's not fiction, which is crazy. But, you know, what do you think? I mean, should we just start blurring the lines a little bit more about what actually happened and what didn't? Or is that, you know, cross some ethical boundary?
I mean, there is this fan fiction that is quite popular on the internet. So, I think that definitely could be a market that you could move into as your career progresses. I mean, I'd love to hear, like, your account of what you imagined Don Nelson was saying in the locker room to his players after last night's game or something like that. And, you know, I think the key is, though, just be upfront with people that, you know, this is a serialized version of the events, not the actual version. But I think people would have a lot of fun with that.
See, when I think that when real writers, you know, I'm talking like real ivory tower writers, the kinds of writers that I did workshops with back in college, they don't really believe in the sort of black and white fiction and nonfiction that you're kind of describing. They don't believe in disclaimers. They only believe in perspective. So, you know, if I was just to imagine Don Nelson, you know, telling Stephen Curry that he's probably the greatest player he's ever coached in the history of his career, or, you know, Nick Batum has fireballs coming out of his elbows when he's shooting jumpers, that kind of thing, they would not say you need a disclaimer. They would just say, go ahead and write it. That's factual. That's accurate because that's your perspective. Should we just start doing this? I don't see why not.
You know, I think that one of the best pieces of writing and most interesting pieces of writing I read all year was on Free Darko about I wish I could remember who was the guest columnist, guest writer who wrote it, but about being friends with Michael Jordan and playing him one-on-one. I thought that was
I saw that. I don't remember who wrote it, but I saw it, and that was a great piece.
Now I'm going to go look it up so that we can give whoever it was a shout-out, and that just seemed like complete jerks on this podcast.
So this is the part where I'm supposed to buy you time by talking and making witty comments.
Yeah.
Now's a good time to plug the fact that we're on Microsoft Zune for all of those of you trying to download us on your Zune. We're in the Zune marketplace. Just look for the giant mugshot of D'Antonio Wingfield, very similar to the giant mugshot of Kevin Pelton, except of D'Antonio and not Kevin.
Oh, okay, here it is. It was Joey from Straight Banging, of course. That was an excellent piece.
So that's exactly what I'm describing, right? We just, you know, kind of mythologize these people and blend fact from fiction. So, you know what, we could really combine these two ideas, like this new movement towards fictionalizing NBA coverage and then also trying to save Kevin Pritchard's job and kind of like produce, you know, tablets of wisdom about all the things that Kevin Pritchard has done. I'm not going to say he walks on water necessarily, but maybe he water skis really well, or maybe, you know, he's not turning, like, water to wine, but he's throwing a killer end-of-season playoff celebration party at a place, you know, like a sports bar. I mean, we could kind of just blend these things slightly to try to accomplish multiple goals, which is to keep Kevin Pritchard, but also to, you know, make NBA coverage more interesting. I think this has potential.
Well, I wish that the fake Kevin Pritchard account would come back on Twitter and lead that charge. I haven't seen that in a while.
Oh, yeah. Not K. Pritchard. Well, yeah, he's dormant. I think his confidence has been shattered by the recent machinations in the front office. Anyway, let's get back on topic, huh? So you've been in jail for a week now, and it's been a wild week. I don't think there's been a bigger story than Brandon Roy going down with the meniscus tear. Should we start there? Obviously, it occurred against the Los Angeles Lakers. He didn't bump knees. He was real careful to say that, but he did kind of get his foot stuck. You know, his body weight kind of applied pressure on his knee in a kind of a strange way. He said he knew he was injured kind of right from the get-go. What was your reaction when you saw the play and then the immediate aftermath? I mean, did you think it was serious or what was your take?
Well, I didn't actually see the play. I was driving home at that point from Portland, and unfortunately it drove me crazy. I couldn't find that game on the radio, even though it was nationally broadcast.
Well, welcome to Portland, but I don't have to tell you. Wait, wasn't it on 95.5?
It was on 95.5, but by the time the game came on, I was like just barely at the edge of the range. So I was hoping I could pick it up on a Seattle station that was, you know, covering taking the ESPN radio feed, but the ESPN station here had baseball. There was the Masters on the other sports station, and then there's a sports station in Everett that sometimes you can pull in that I sometimes use, and they were playing NASCAR. So, you know, it was that kind of a day. So the Blazers need to get their Seattle radio deal together. That's the moral of that story, I guess.
Well, that's the ninth deal they need to get together in order of importance. Let's be real about that. Anyway, so you didn't see the play, but did you see the replay of it at least? I mean, do you even know who Brandon Roy is? Or
no, I don't think I ever saw the play. I don't think I ever watched it. I just read about the aftermath.
It was kind of an innocuous play. It was the kind of thing like you wouldn't really think, you know. I mean, obviously he came up a little bit strange afterwards, tried to go back at the game. That didn't really work out so well. So it's just another one of these little tweak, fluke things that happens, you know, seemingly to the Blazers more often than any other team in the league. So I was initially doing my research, and it was kind of strange how it all played out because there was such a, you know, obviously it's Brandon, so there's such a demand for information that they feel like, you know, the Blazers do, that they feel like they have to get information out as quickly as possible, even if it's not necessarily complete, just to provide some answers. And actually that was the case. You know, the Sunday night news people all wanted to have an update, for their 11 o'clock news after the game, but, you know, they're down in L.A., and they're flying back to Portland because, you know, it was an afternoon game, so they're trying to get information for those newscasts. Obviously, the paper wants it for the next morning. You know, obviously, people on the Internet want it within 3 seconds. So, you know, they were really, you know, quickly trying to get information out. First, it comes out as a, you know, a contusion, which, or, you know, bone bruise, which isn't the worst thing in the world. LaMarcus Aldridge was able to get over his earlier in the season pretty quickly. But, you know, kind of from the beginning, Brandon Roy was playing doctor himself, which shows you how many injuries he's been through and that he's able to so accurately assess his own health. He knew it was something worse. He even had specifically said he thought it was going to be a meniscus problem. There is kind of this weird, you know, I told you this before, I've had meniscus surgery, and there's this weird clicking feeling kind of when you move your leg, and it's discomfort. It's not always necessarily shooting pain, but it kind of feels like someone maybe put like a Lego or something in the back of your knee. And so when you move, it's just like, just feels really weird and disorienting. Like you're, you know, it's kind of limits your range of motion a little bit. It just feels wrong. And it's, you know, pretty easy and pretty immediate of a sensation when it happens. And I think, you know, that's kind of what Brandon was feeling. And obviously he's had it before in his other knee. So, you know, he could remember back to that feeling. So he was kind of, you know, professing straight from the start before they even looked at the MRI fully that, you know, he thought it was going to be a meniscus problem. It did turn out to be a meniscus problem. And now we're at the point where he's got a decision to make whether he wants to play, if he's able to play. They're going to assess him tomorrow. You know, he's saying all the things that, you know, about him wanting to play, but it's going to be really difficult for him with that injury to make an impact. So I'm approaching this playoff series, you know, kind of as if he's not going to be able to play just based on, you know, his body language, you know, his disappointed feelings before the game on Monday night when he addressed the media. And then just also the fact that he realizes, you know, he's been through it before and you just can't play on it. It's not the kind of injury you're going to be able to play 100% on. It's not a matter of toughness. You know, it's just a matter of not having a knee that's right. So I know you recapped and previewed the series and we'll go into that later, but any other thoughts on Roy? You know, this is obviously, what, his third or fourth injury now over the course of his playing career. He's made some comments about, you know, maybe he doesn't expect or doesn't look forward to the future, you know, as being a 15-year NBA player. Are those warning signs if you're a Blazers fan?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the long term it's troubling. And you mentioned he had the surgery on his right knee, on his meniscus, but then also in college he had some of the meniscus removed from his left knee. Wait, am I getting this backwards? I think I got this backwards. Yes, his left knee was with the Blazers. His right knee was in college and then now. So, you know, at some point what we see is when that cartilage wears down and is removed, you just don't have as much protection for the knee. There's ultimately perhaps bone-on-bone contact that may have played a role in causing this. And that's, you know, what causes the brings about the microfracture knee surgery that so many guys seem to be having nowadays. So, I mean, I think down the line, it's certainly not good news for the Blazers, and I think it reflects kind of some of the concerns that people had about Brandon entering the draft and you know, part of why he fell on draft day. So, I mean, I think the Blazers still, you know, have to be very thrilled that they have him, and I don't think it's even enough of a concern as far as, like, the next contract that he's starting with the extension this summer, but way down the line, yeah.
Hey, did you name Brandon this year to your first, second, or third team All-NBA?
He did not make it to either to any of my three All-NBA teams. If there was a fourth team, he probably would have been on there, but I chose Manu Ginobili over him for the third team.
And see, I think that's fair. You know, he basically missed a quarter of the season this year. And I think if there's any lesson I've taken from this NBA season, it's that we underrate the importance of health when we're assessing you know, players and their impacts on wins and losses, because the Blazers are a significantly better team if he only misses half as many games as he did in the win-loss column, in the standings. I mean, all of the jockeying between the 8th, the 7th, and the 6th seed that the Blazers were involved in is much less of an issue if Brandon is able to play through that entire stretch, you know, January and February, and he doesn't have the hamstring issue. And their ability to succeed in the playoffs obviously is going to be, you know, incredibly different, if not totally different, if Brandon's able to play at 100%, you know, in sync, ready to go, as opposed to whatever he's going to be able to play or potentially not play now that he's had this knee injury. So, You know, I think that, you know, you made the right call there. It's tough to think that Brandon's not a top six guard in this league, but, you know, the results kind of speak for themselves this year, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, even when he was able to play, there was a lot of time and period where he was limited by the hamstring and wasn't quite the same Brandon Roy that we've known in the past. You know, I think the difficulty people sometimes have with injuries is not thinking of them in these absolute terms, like either, well, Brandon Roy is going to get injured, and Andre Miller isn't going to get injured because he hasn't missed a game in so long. Well, it's not quite like that. It's a game of percentages, and, you know, like anything else. So certainly the chances that Roy or Greg Oden are going to miss time are higher, you would think, given their track record and than just, you know, the stress that past injuries have put on them than someone else is. But nothing is ever guaranteed either way, positively or negatively, so it's certainly possible that Roy could play the next 10 years and not have any knee issues again. So, you know, that's the nature of injuries.
You know, and this is where the kind of mental thing gets into it too, is because I think if you had, you know, made that statement to Brandon on Monday night, I think his mentality would have kind of been more of a, maybe not woe is me, but, you know, pretty dejected, and kind of the idea that, you know, this is a reality for him that he's going to have to continue to deal with, you know, being injured and managing his pain and thinking about timelines on scheduling surgeries and all the kind of stuff that you don't want athletes to ever think about. And that's kind of become his life a little bit, and you could tell it was getting to him. And you feel really bad for him because nobody wants it more than he does on the Blazers. I mean, there's absolutely no question he has the biggest competitive spirit of any person on the Blazers. And to see someone like that hopeless and helpless like he was on Monday night was tough. And it was just another one of those situations. You know, I wrote about it kind of being like at ground zero, you know, after some really bad news. And that's what it was like. Anyway, the Blazers obviously had to play without Brandon on Monday against Oklahoma City in a huge game that had huge implications. And then also last night in a game that was essentially meaningless against Golden State. Let's look at that Oklahoma City game. You did watch that, didn't you?
I did.
Oh, nice of you to carve some time out. You're probably just watching for Durant, Scottie Brooks, and all your friends over there, Sam Presti and all those guys. Probably just watching for them, weren't you?
Believe it or not, I actually do watch the majority of the Blazers games.
Oh, just not any of the ones that we talk about on the podcast. I see. Okay.
More even than the, you know, I even watched the Blazers play the Knicks. I mean, that's commitment.
That is commitment. Oh God, I sat at the arena, but I just closed my eyes. I mean, I wasn't there. I was there, but I wasn't there. So, what did you think about the Oklahoma City game? Break it down for me. Blazers pulled out a big win. Didn't have Roy, kind of rallied together. Big contributions from Miller and Camby. What was your takeaway from that?
Yeah, it was the mid-30s crew carrying the load for the Blazers. I mean, Andre Miller was phenomenal, completely outplayed Russell Westbrook at both ends of the floor. I mean, Saba Savalosha was defending him most of the time, but he took Westbrook out of the game on defense in addition to what he did on the offensive end. And then Camby, I mean, it's kind of interesting because, you know, Bill Simmons in particular has played up this Oklahoma City should have traded for Camby, and it was the Thunder and the Blazers were the two teams I identified as being really good fits for Camby before the trade deadline. And boy, you know, I don't know how much Oklahoma City actually regrets that because they've got such a young team and such a bright future ahead of them. But boy, you saw what he could have done for them and has done for the Blazers on full display on Monday night. And I mean, you know, to be scoring in addition to everything he does defensively and on the glass and things like that, it was a terrific effort. I mean, you know, you've watched and broken down all these games without Roy. I mean, do you feel like there's an element to which the team is tougher to defend without him because of the fact that you don't know where the ball is going on each possession?
No, I don't think so. I think offensively they're always going to be better with Brandon, even if, you know, there's more movement and there's more different ways they can beat you. They just have so many more inconsistent parts. You have a guy like Martell Webster who just can't, you know, consistently deliver off the dribble. You have guys like, you know, Nicholas Batum who are good at catching and finishing, but also not good at creating their own points. You got Aldridge who, you know, is great at sometimes, like he was, you know, absolutely phenomenal on Monday night in terms of scoring late in the game, but he's not always on. If his jumper's not there, then his game, you know, becomes a little bit more one-dimensional. Andre has been playing great, limiting turnovers great, shooting high percentage great. But that's not how it's always been over the course of the entire season. Camby can't really create offense for himself. So, you know, I would, you know, tend to subscribe to McMillan's philosophy, you know, late in games when he does have Brandon, which is let Brandon, not necessarily always run the 1-4, but let him make the decisions, let him run pick and rolls, let him read the defense, let him try to find the open man, because that's going to be a better overall philosophy, because he can get to the line, because he doesn't ever turn the ball over, because he shoots such a high percentage from the mid-range. You know, I'm fine with all that. It is a little bit more aesthetically pleasing, I think, especially when they're on against a team like Oklahoma City, but that doesn't necessarily always translate into victories. I think over the course of a 7-game series against Phoenix, they're going to have some real question marks in terms of if they can keep up scoring offensively. But, you know, what I really did like on Monday night was the defensive effort. And, you know, I've never been a huge fan of Brandon Roy on defense. I think I wrote at the beginning of the season that that was one area where he could really step up his game and, you know, embrace the role of locking down the opponent's best player. And I'm just not sure he has the skill set or the mentality to be a true defensive stopper. And when you get guys, you know, like a Martell Webster when he's focused, a Nicholas Batum when he's really on, and you get the cumulative effect of those guys, plus Marcus Camby when he's playing motivated, which he absolutely is right now, and a guy like Andre Miller who's really stepped up his defensive game towards the end of the season like you've written about, I think you can really do some things in the defensive end there with that combined effort.
You know, I crunched the numbers on that as part of my research for the preview I posted on Basketball Prospectus, and it didn't end up making it into the final cut because the surprising thing I found was the Blazers' defensive rating is higher in those games that Roy has missed than any other way you want to slice it. At least the comparison I did was, you know, by starting center, I did mention him there, and the most of those games were with Juwan Howard as the starting center, so you'd expect the defensive rating to be higher because of that, but it was even higher with Roy out of the lineup than with Howard as the starting center all games. So I wonder if, you know, that may be true at late in games, but whether with Rudy Fernandez really playing most of those minutes in place of Brandon, whether it may not actually be such a good thing for the defense.
Well, I think if you're taking the overall combination of Roy having the ability, you know, if you do want to go defensive, you have Roy playing majority of the minutes with Webster filling in behind him, I think that's always going to be better than any situation that involves Rudy playing defense. Because I'm not sure, who can Rudy guard? Is there anyone in the league that Rudy can guard? I mean, he can't guard ones. He can't guard dominant twos. You know, he can kind of guard, you know, stand in the corner three-point shooters because he can play the passing lanes a little bit. But otherwise, who's he guarding?
I mean, I think that would be the ideal matchup, and I think you may be able to do okay with him in this series if he's defending, you know, Jason Richardson is not the one-on-one player he used to be. He's primarily a three-point shooter, Grant Hill, and especially, you know, someone like Jared Dudley has size on him off the bench, but again, is not someone that's creating a lot of his own offense. So, you know, I mean, I don't know if he's the worst defender in the league or anything.
Well, so what did you think about the combination that we hadn't seen previously, hardly at all, of Batum and Webster alongside each other? I mean, that was a completely new look, and they didn't have Howard behind them. Obviously, they had Camby behind them, so they were able to gamble and really get up on the perimeter, you know, challenge every catch, move their feet, make people work, rotate well, which isn't something they've always done. I mean, that was a nice look for the Blazers.
Well, the other thing they were able to do, and I think you pointed out, I believe it was the pass that Durant threw to the referee and threw away as a turnover, but where they switched, you know, defensively Webster and Batum, and they could feel totally comfortable there because they weren't putting in not only any kind of a size mismatch, but a defensive quality change by going from Batum to Webster, or Webster to Batum, as it was on that play. I can't remember which one.
Yeah, no, they definitely did that because, you know, he came across the court. Batum stepped out because Webster was staying on Jeff Green to make sure he didn't pop a three real quick. They were down six trying to score quickly, so that was the situation there. But, you know, Nate had mentioned that was kind of his strategy throughout the game, really, was to use those two guys interchangeably on Durant. You know, the big question I think that Nick's going to have coming in the playoffs, and, you know, it depends on who he necessarily matches up with. I think it might not be horrible because, you know, Phoenix doesn't have an elite wing scorer. But, you know, the one question that I worry about with Nick is, you know, is he going to find himself in foul trouble because he's still so young? He is so aggressive, and he takes some chances, you know, and they're calculated risks, but they are risks. And in the playoffs, when you're a young guy, you know, doing those kinds of things on defense, a lot of times they'll ding you. So I think it's good that they're not necessarily playing a guy like Carmelo Anthony, you know, or a guy like Durant or a guy like Kobe Bryant in the first round, because I could easily see, you know, Nick neutered by the officials a little bit, you know, going against a Grant Hill, you know, maybe he doesn't have those same problems. Although I think you pointed out that they might try to use him on Steve Nash. Here's a question for you from that piece. Why did you say that Nick struggles with the pick and rolls that Phoenix sets? Is it just because everybody struggles with those pick and rolls because Nash is so good, or is it something about Nick specifically as a defender?
I don't think he's very good at playing on ball screens. I think that's probably the weakest part of his defensive game, is my opinion.
Just he doesn't. I mean, is he not fighting through hard enough? Is he slow to react when the screens come in? What's the part? Or just in general, it's like he's a little bit confused.
You know, just I don't think he just has the experience of playing those. Now, you pointed out that he's better at getting through those screens than the guys the Blazers were playing earlier in the season. I think that's something we've discussed. But, you know, I would say he's better when you're putting him in an isolation setting and he's able to just spread out, use his wingspan, and the fact that he moves well laterally, whereas when you're getting another defender involved, it's you know, that much complication for him.
I think I agree with you there. I think it's an issue of reps too. Is, you know, he's had so many more reps against guys who, you know, do most of their damage in isolation. Guys like Melo, guys like Durant, guys like Kobe Bryant. That, you know, he's done that so many more times, hundreds if not thousands of times at this point, from a possession standpoint. That's, you know, that comfort level is coming from the experience. You know, I think he has a fair amount of experience in those situations. Whereas, you know, he could get pick and rolled to death. I think that's definitely a concern for the Blazers. But, you know, anyone could. And I do think they'll probably stick more with Andre on Steve Nash and just take their chances, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think where we could see Batum more is depending on how Nate spots the rotations and the minutes. If he's doing that in the second unit defensively, then you're probably not going to want to have Jared Bayless defending Nash if they're on the floor at all against each other.
Oh, so you're going to assume that Jared Bayless is actually going to make the trip down for game 1 and 2? I thought they might not even bring him.
After as well as Travis Diener played last night, you thought that he might be out of the rotation?
Well, I think they're just going to run Andre into the ground, I mean.
it's possible, but I think you want to keep him fresh. I mean, you don't, you know, he is 34.
Yeah, I know. I'm just kidding. It'll be funny because, well, we'll get to more playoff stuff after we cover this fiasco that was last night's game. So did you watch last night's game, Blazers versus Warriors?
I watched the first three quarters of it in a bar, so not an ideal setting for analysis, but, I could keep an eye on what was going on and the big numbers that the Warriors, a few remaining healthy players were putting up. Although, sadly, I missed the final quarter, so I missed the wackiness with Devin George fouling out and ultimately re-injuring the game.
It was insane. Well, first of all, is it true the rumors that at the sports bar people were chanting Pendergraph, Pendergraph? I heard it was sweeping the entire Northwest as he dunked, you know, whatever it was, 15 times on his way to a career-high 23 points.
I can neither confirm nor deny those reports.
Wait, so you weren't taking your shirt off, swinging your tie over your head, and leaving the chant?
not last night, no.
Okay, well, I can't really blame you. That game was really hard to watch until it got wacky at the end. It was unlike anything I've seen, though, that whole Don Nelson fiasco. And there was a real problem in the arena because, you know, unlike the TV audience who was kind of clued in on exactly what was happening, it wasn't totally clear why Nelson was arguing and exactly what he was trying to do, given how many bodies he had on the bench. I don't think people realized that those guys were, you know, too injured to play in Nelson's determination after the game. And so they just kind of thought, you know, Don Nelson was being Don Nelson. I think to a certain degree he kind of was. The phrase I told you before the podcast I wanted to use was Nelson was kind of waddling onto the moral high ground when he was arguing to the refs. I mean, he seemed like this was an issue of, you know, he didn't want to have, you know, the legal ramifications on his hands if a guy like Chris Hunter, you know, got injured again after already being injured and was being forced to play by the referees. He didn't want to put Morrow or Turiaf into the game because he was convinced that they were too injured to function. And he eventually did, but then sent them straight to the locker room, which left sort of an iconic photo of just a completely empty Golden State Warriors bench during a game that they ended up winning, which, you know, if there's anything that would sum up their entire season, well, not the winning part maybe, but the idea that they only have assistant coaches and trainers and not a single player who's on the bench at the end of a game, with Steph Curry scoring 42 points. I thought that was a little bit artistic and ironic and, you know, symbolic of everything they've gone through. I mean, if this is the way that Don Nelson goes out as a coach, which I guess it possibly could be if, if Golden State's ownership changes hands? I mean, this is pretty much the way you would expect it to go out, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, Don Nelson, you know, has always been known for being wacky, but it's gone to a new level the last couple of years in Golden State. And yeah, I mean, you know, I really think probably someone should write a book about this season for the Warriors, because just when you think of everything that's gone on, and you know, this isn't the first game. They beat Dallas by using what, 6 players down there back in December or something like that. You know, there's all these rules about you got to have 8 players dressed and so on and so forth. And unless there's suspensions or a trade, they almost never come into play. And then to see, you know, the Warriors have 3 guys who are, or 2 guys who are dressed strictly because of the fact that they have to be dressed, and a third who gets injured during the game. I mean, when does that happen? That doesn't happen. Nobody had ever heard of anyone using that rule about, you know, once all your players are fouled out who are able to play, you know, the 5th player is able to continue in the game, but it's a technical foul. You know, I mean, it had never been enforced in our lifetimes, and the Warriors did it twice this season. That is insane.
And it looked like he was actively looking to exploit it too. He like really wanted to do it. It was like his dream. This is like a guy who's just lost his season on Madden or FIFA on the Xbox, and it's just like, I'm going to see the craziest things that I can pull off. I mean, that's kind of like what he was doing. It seemed like mad scientist style. Well, I mean, it's not as bad as last year when he was drinking beer with a local writer in the locker room for no reason while his entire team was already on the team bus. So, I mean, his just kind of goes with the territory with him, I guess.
Hey, when you're the winningest coach in NBA history, I suppose you feel like you can do whatever you want, so... Hey, he's earned it.
That's exactly what Nate said. All right, enough talk about these meaningless end-of-season games. Let's get should we get to the playoff series? Are we ready to go there?
I think we should.
All right, full breakdown. You know, Dave posted a bunch of stats this morning. Obviously, you posted a bunch of stats. You looked at different matchups and offense, defense, and whatnot. You concluded with Phoenix winning in 6 games. I think Henry Abbott from True Hoop actually picked the Blazers to win. I think John Hollinger said the Suns wouldn't struggle at all to beat the Blazers. So there's a few expert opinions. What ultimately was the determining factor for you to settle on Suns in 6? And, you know, what put an odds on what you think the Blazers, you know, potential is to win this series. Is it 25%? Do they have a 40% chance? And let's just assume that, you know, Brandon, you know, probably won't contribute, but he might contribute slightly.
Yeah, I would say probably somewhere around 1-4, 1-5, 20-25% chance. You know, I mean, everybody is close enough in the Western Conference, and the Blazers, you know, the Blazers have beaten some good teams. We just talked about them beating the Thunder. They beat the Lakers in L.A. without Brandon Roy. So it's not like they can't do it. But I think even if they were at full strength, I think Phoenix would be the favorite in the series, both because of home court advantage and, you know, like I wrote about, the one big thing that really separates these two teams in my mind is the quality of the bench. You know, we've talked to death probably the Blazers' struggles with the bench the last month or so. And Phoenix, on the other hand, just has this great second unit that, you know, like the best reserve groups we can remember, has developed an identity of its own separate from the starters. Phoenix is one of the few teams you'll see potentially in the playoffs run out an entire bench unit where they put Goran Dragic and Barbosa in the backcourt. They'll put Jared Dudley and Lewis Amundsen at forward and Channing Frye in the middle, or however you want to say Amundsen and Frye. You know, part of the fact that Frye is essentially a starter for them at this point, realistically, although Jaren Collins is getting the token minutes of the starter right now with Robin Lopez being out of the lineup. But those 5 guys are, you know, mostly young, and they're playing really well together. Dragic has just come into his own this season. Jared Dudley has developed into a terrific 3-point shooter. Amundsen brings energy. Frye is spacing the floor. It's a really good group, and I think the Blazers are going to struggle with it.
You know, I call Dragic, I call him Dragic Johnson, because that guy is the most improved. Shouldn't he be in the discussion for most improved player? This guy didn't know the rules of basketball last year, and now he's a big-time contributing backup point guard who Gentry felt totally fine with playing huge minutes to close the season as they were incredibly hot. I mean, this guy is not the same player he was last year, to the degree almost of like a Kevin Durant from where he was last year to where he is this year. Or am I overstating it?
Well, as you know, first off, I don't care about the Most Improved Player Award anymore. But that being said, I think that Dragic is a guy who has definitely made huge strides. And you saw it, I think, a little bit towards the end of last season. And then when I plugged his numbers into Shaney, the projection system last summer, it said he's going to make this huge jump and be about an average player. And lo and behold, I think he's even probably improved more than the numbers had to say. So that's remarkable. Because, I mean, I think there may have been entire blogs devoted to how bad Goran Dragic was last year.
Well, honestly, he had a lobotomy. You know, it's not like he just was, you know, smart and he wasn't used to the game, he got smarter. It's like he got a completely different brain and now he knows the rules of the game and now he understands the pace of the game and now he actually has confidence in himself to be able to put the basketball in the hoop. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, he could be an X factor here. I would, you know, never have said last year at this time that I would prefer to have Dragic Johnson over Jared Bayless. But I don't know how you couldn't at this point, you know. And it's not even really that close.
Yeah, and I mean, besides production, it's also about trust from the coaches. So you mentioned that with Gentry, where the other night against Utah in that must-win game for the Suns to secure, or against Utah, against the Nuggets, I should say, in a must-win game for the Suns to secure home court advantage, he played the entire fourth quarter because of the fact that, you know, there was no need to bring back in Steve Nash. He was playing well enough on his own. So, as you compare it to Nate McMillan right now, clearly has very little faith in Jared Bayless, and we're looking to get Andre Miller back on the floor as quickly as possible.
Well, here's another question for you. Another name that you mentioned was Jared Dudley, you know, the Bill Simmons super podcast guest superstar, which is actually a great podcast. I don't know if you checked it out, but it was pretty good. Dudley versus Rudy. Now, someone asked me during the offseason, given that they make similarly small salaries, if the Blazers would be willing to trade Rudy Fernandez for Jared Dudley. And I thought about it, and I was like, yeah, it'd be a great trade for the Blazers. And then I thought about it a little bit more, and I was like, the Suns would never do that, would they?
Boy, I mean, I think they might have before last season, but you know, Dudley is another guy who has developed that three-point range, and it's totally changed his game because of his ability to space the floor. And then, you know, he's always been a really good hustle player, was a great undersized rebounder at Boston College. So and he's a pretty strong defensive player as well. So right now he's probably bringing more to the table than Rudy, yeah.
Man, and that's another one where you would have said last year, like you said, same thing. I don't know. Is this an indictment of Nate McMillan that he's not getting the most out of his bench players and that guy like Alvin Gentry, you know, who steps into a situation that wasn't really his own making and kind of totally transformed it and now is getting, you know, huge contributions from all these random players, Channing Frye included? I mean, is that where we start to say that maybe Gentry should have gotten some more Coach of the Year love? Or is it just the fact that, you know, when you're playing with Steve Nash and you get that shine from him, Amari's really stepped his game up, which makes life easier for everybody else? I mean, who are you giving that credit to? Is it to both sides or what?
Well, you know, I think the one thing with Nate is let's keep in mind that a lot of it is minutes and a lot of it is confidence. So right now that the Blazers have this starting five, you know, prior to Brandon Roy's injury that was locked in, there wasn't going to be a lot of minutes for those bench guys. And, you know, Martell Webster in particular is someone I think that is pretty clearly a rhythm player, a streaky player. You know, if he's playing 5 to 10 minutes a night, it's going to be hard for him to bring a lot of production. So that's a case where, you know, I think he'll do better in this series because of the fact that he'll get more regular minutes because of Roy's injury. But, what the Blazers did in December when everybody was so banged up, I mean, you're talking about Nate's gotten production out of Bayless for a long stretch of the season. You know, he's been able to have Juwan Howard as his starting center and win games, which I think is pretty stunning, all things considered. You know, he trusted Dante Cunningham for a while. So, you know, I don't think this is something that Nate necessarily can't do or anything like that. But Gentry does definitely deserve a lot of credit. And then, you know, I think Steve Kerr went out and got some quality players on the cheap, and it turns out that his first set of draft picks or his second set of draft picks with Lopez and Dragic, who both looked just terrible as rookies, it turns out they can play.
Okay, so let's flip this discussion around a little bit, and let's say what do the Blazers need to do to fulfill that 1-4, 1-5 chance that you've given them to win the series? I mean, is it a matter of Jared Bayless blowing up like he did back in December and having that huge, you know, breakout game on national TV where he's trash-talking with Gentry and the Suns bench and hitting his threes and he's just on fire and nobody can stop him? He's getting to the basket at will. I mean, is he the guy who really needs to step up and provide that spark, or is it a matter of Martell Webster playing like he played in January, or is it a matter of the team just totally locking down on defense, you know, to a degree that maybe we haven't really seen except for that Oklahoma City game? Or is it a matter of Brandon Roy coming back and, you know, being a miracle worker? Or is it LaMarcus Aldridge matching Amari Stoudemire point for point, rebound for rebound? Or is it all of those things? Is that what it's going to take for the Blazers to beat the third-seeded Phoenix Suns?
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's any one scenario, but I think a lot of those things you mentioned. I think the big thing on offense for the Blazers will be you've got to have three scoring threats. And if Roy is not a part of it, then I think Andre Miller and LaMarcus Aldridge at this point are givens. And I don't think the way that the Suns are built defensively that they're really going to be able to take those two guys out of the game unless they just completely sell out and double team. So it's one more guy has got to step up and join them on a night-to-night basis. And it can be a different guy each night. It doesn't have to be the same one each night. It might be Nicholas Batum in one game. It could be Rudy Fernandez another. It could be Martell Webster a third. You know, Bayless to me is probably down on that list right now, but he's streaky enough that if he gets hot and McMillan sticks with him, especially goes with a backcourt of him and Andre Miller, puts him off the ball like he was when he was playing well in December, then it's certainly possible that that could happen too. You know, at the defensive end of the floor, you're not going to stop the Suns, especially the way they shoot the three. You know, I think it's just a matter of being able to do what you can to slow them down, keep them out of the fast break game, keep Nash and Stoudemire from just destroying you on the pick and roll and forcing you to bring that help and creating those open threes for the other guys like Dudley and Richardson and Fry who are spacing the floor. So, you know, whether it's Miller or whether it's Batum, you know, being able to contain Nash and I think you probably want to try and make him a scorer as opposed to a passer. I think teams have had success with that, generally speaking, in the past. And then, you know, covering Stoudemire is going to require team defense. It's not going to be just about LaMarcus Aldridge or Marcus Camby or whoever that matchup ends up being because of the fact that when they get Nash and Stoudemire in the pick and roll, you're going to have to bring in a third defender to stop that. There's no way two guys can stop that as good as it is.
If there's one thing that I like about for the Blazers coming into the playoffs this series, I think it's the mental aspect and the ability to sell themselves on the fact that they're the underdogs, that they don't have to deal with the expectations that they had last season, you know, being you know, the favorite, so to speak, against the Houston Rockets. They don't necessarily have to deal with a team that's overwhelmingly physical that might, you know, might be able to intimidate them. I do like the mental approach that the Blazers are taking. I mean, even last night, you know, there was a certain kind of confidence, but also, you know, it wasn't like an overwhelming confidence or cockiness. I mean, you know, they don't know if they have Brandon Roy. So I think that leaves some uncertainty in, you know, in a lot of guys. But at the same time, it's sort of like the expectations are off, the pressure is off. There's not this, you know, craziness that there was surrounding the entire experience last year with the playoff rally and, you know, with, you know, going through it for the first time, the coaches breaking down the tape, you know, rushing to do that as they hadn't had to do the previous couple years. And there's a sense that they've been through this before. They learned their lessons from last year. There's not the same pressure. You know, a guy like Martell Webster and frankly, a lot of the Blazers, you know, even a guy like Jared Bayless kind of, you know, gets off on having that chip on his shoulder, gets off on being the underdog. A guy like Nicholas Batum is more comfortable without necessarily the spotlight right on him. And, you know, maybe that will lead to some better performances. You know, there's new veterans who can kind of take some of that brunt of the expectations and the media coverage, you know, and the interviews and guys like Marcus Camby and Juwan Howard and Andre Miller. And you can see those guys really comfortable in those roles last night. I mean, Juwan Howard was out there answering question after question after question after the game, making sure that, you know, even though he didn't even really play last night, making sure that, you know, he was the guy who was dealing with, you know, the intensity of the local media, because frankly, it does ratchet up, and it already was last night. I mean, there was a lot of cameras there, all the TV stations there doing live shots, cutting together stories, talking about who the potential matchups were, already wanting to know the guys' opinions about how they would match up against a team like the Suns, who are such an offensive juggernaut. And, you know, last year, those kinds of things got to some of the guys, and, you know, it showed. You know, it showed how they came out of the gate in game one, and that wasn't necessarily what we saw last night. So you would hope that also with an extra day, now that they're not playing until Sunday, they would come out of the gate pretty, you know, pretty strongly down in Phoenix. But with that said, you know, you're walking into the teeth of a pretty angry, efficient beast in the Suns, and I would expect them to be completely ready too from a mental standpoint, wouldn't you? I mean, like you pointed out, they haven't won a series in a couple of years. You know, I think they're a little bit extra determined this year.
And, you know, they're coming into the playoffs – as hot as pretty much anyone in the Western Conference. You know, I go back to, I think it was our last WinCast we did, and I would like to say that I was dead wrong, because I said that this race for the second and third seeds was going to come down to Dallas and Utah, that Phoenix and Denver, because of their injuries, were going to be out of it. And as it was, both of those teams were in the discussion the final day of the season, and Phoenix ultimately got home court advantage, and they did it by beating Denver pretty comfortably at home, and then just destroying Utah last night on the road. So there's a lot to be said for the way Phoenix is coming in here. That said, you know, I think the Blazers have to be happy with this matchup, you know, especially as compared to the possibility of playing Utah. Even Denver, with the way they've struggled, I don't think is ideal because of their front court. You know, they match up well with Phoenix. It's a team they've beaten in the regular season, and I think that's what's going to give them a lot of that confidence.
Word. So I think that, you know, we could say maybe the mental side, or the, you know, I think the Blazers' mental side does negate a little bit of the Suns' strength. I mean, even though the Suns are peaking at the right time and really clicking on all cylinders, I think that the Blazers are able to find motivation from the fact that they've beaten the Suns in the past. They know the Suns pretty well. But also, I think that McMillan and Gentry is a pretty good coaching matchup in terms of, I mean, I don't necessarily think that Nate's going to get out-coached, guaranteed. Like, I would expect him to be against a guy like Jerry Sloan.
Yeah, it's a different matchup for him, you know. And this is, you know, this is going to be a little bit different experience for Alvin Gentry. He's coached in the playoffs a couple of times, but I don't think, you know, going back to his time in Detroit or Miami, that he was necessarily the favorite in any series. So it'll be a little bit different for him as well.
All right. We've broken down the series pretty thoroughly. I saw your prediction. Correct me if I'm wrong. Your prediction was Suns in six?
Yes, it was.
Okay, well, last year I totally botched it and picked the Blazers over the Rockets, which was not the best decision. And then I ended up finishing in, like, last place in that True Hoop prediction poll because I was picking all sorts of upsets. So that makes me, you know, a little bit scared to pull the trigger on a Blazers upset, which, you know, I think I would have been anyways, just given Brandon Roy's status. Yada, yada, yada. So that comes down to Suns in five, six, or seven. I really don't want to pick him in six because you already did, and I hate copying you. I'm going to go Suns in five. How's that sound?
Wow. Wow. I'm surprised you're going to be more pessimistic.
Well, you know, honestly, I couldn't say Suns in four because that would mean that KP would be fired during the game four at halftime by Paul Allen in front of all the Blazers fans. So I think he's going to have a little reprieve, and then I think he's going to, you know, he's going to watch his team go down in the fifth game back in Phoenix.
Well, we'll see how it plays out. I mean, if nothing else, it should be a fun series to watch.
I was being a little sarcastic there. I hope nobody took offense to that. I really would like to see the Blazers push this as long as possible, because I think that every win here has implications for the offseason. I think if you push Phoenix to seven, I think that that could be a win for the current management team. Because, you know, you've got Brandon going down, and it shows, hey, look, we've got enough pieces here that we can compete with people. We should bring these guys back, and with Odin and Brandon and retool, and maybe with a new draft pick, you know, we can make some, you know, a serious push. I think if it's Blazers in four, or sorry, Suns in four, Suns in five, then, you know, that propensity of Paul Allen's to kind of, you know, want a quick fix or want to change directions could really flare up. You know, how would you read that? Do you think it would make a difference at all? I mean, a first-round exit is a first-round exit, or do you think, you know, how long it goes, you know, could influence things?
I don't think it's going to make a huge difference either way. I mean, and it depends not just, you know, the length of the series, but also if it's something like where it becomes blindingly obvious that Brandon Roy is the biggest difference, well, it's not like there's anything anyone could do about that. So, you know, you just got to chalk that up to this is a horrible season of bad luck with the injuries and move on from there.
All right. Well, I'm going to stick with Suns in five. And I was kidding. I think KP will make it at least through draft day. But it's hard to say. He still hasn't been seen with Paul Allen together. It's been months now. It's pretty wacky. It's going to be a wild next 2 weeks for the Blazers in terms of the playoffs, and also, you know, a wild countdown until draft day. I feel like the longest part of the season, and this has been a really long season, but I think the longest part of the season is going to be from when the Blazers playoffs end until the draft, because it's going to be just a lot of uncertainty. But there's plenty of time for that in the future. KP, I'm glad you're out of jail. It's great to talk to you. I hope nothing weird happened to you in there. I mean, there wasn't any, like, traumatizing events, was there?
You know, I have only nice things to say about the Multnomah County Jail.
Well, I hope to read your five thoughts on the subject. Hopefully you'll post those this weekend.
Yeah, well, we're going to get to the playoff previews, and then they'll be up next.
Delirious, more serious, so killer did mixtapes. CEOs heard, now here come Big Cake. But one cat said, Cam, you better recoup, for you back on your block, baby, dead on your stoop. But unhook me up with all this cheddar and loot. The best rap deal of all time, next to Snoop. Money more to clutch, money more to touch. I don't just rhyme, I own liquor stores and such. But yeah, yo, the rap game remind me of the crack game. Niggas wanna get their gun, then start the clap game. For that fame, grow entertainment, sports, drugs, entertainment, to the arraignment killer.